You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There are many reasons some people succeed while others do not, but when it comes to the underachievement of entire groups, the explanations can be contentious and consequential. The social psychologist Claude Steele says every one of us is affected by stereotypes, but that the consequences are greater for members of groups that consistently underachieve. His book, Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us, is published by Norton. I'm very pleased that it brings Claude Steele, who is currently provost at Columbia University, to our show. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Perhaps we should begin by defining some terms. What is stereotype threat?
It's simply whenever you're in a situation or you're doing something for which a negative stereotype about one of your identities, say your age or your religion, is relevant to you and relevant to what you're doing in that situation, then you know you could be judged or treated in terms of that negative stereotype. And if you care about what you're doing, that can be threatening and distracting, upsetting.
A stereotype threat and identity threat the same thing?
Identity threat is a little broader. Stereotype threat is a type of identity threat. We were just talking a few seconds ago about living in Salt Lake City.
You were, not me.
Yeah, I lived in Salt Lake City.
I've been there once.
And as a non-Mormon, you feel that's an identity there. In fact, you're called Gentiles. And even if you're Jewish, you're called Gentiles in Salt Lake City. So that's a situation where you're not in the in-group. You don't have power. You're not connected to the center of things. But you don't know about a particular stereotype. They may not have a particular stereotype. You just know you're not in the group that's in. And so the term identity threat tries to capture that broader sense of where your identity can feel disenfranchised or imperiled.
But as an African-American in Salt Lake City, I don't want to pick on Salt Lake City, but until fairly recently, the Church of the Latter-day Saints actually was accused of discriminating against black people. Yes. And you were living there. I suspect you were aware of certain attitudes that people had about you when you walked into a room. No matter how well you were dressed, no matter how well-spoken you were, they had certain attitudes.
Indeed, we were there in 1971, so this is before the church had its quote, revelation, which finally allowed African-Americans to be part of the church and part of the hierarchy of the church. So we were there in a time when prejudice against African-Americans was explicit. There were a lot of other groups who were non-Mormon who sort of bonded under this label of Gentile, and the group of them was too big to have a particular set of stereotypes about them. You just knew you weren't Mormon.
And you say people develop certain strategies to deal with these things, like the strategy that is described in your title, Whistling Vivaldi. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's a great story from the experience of now a New Yorker, Brent Staples, who's the editorialist for the New York Times and editorialist for the Times. When he was a graduate student in Chicago, dressed as a student walking down the streets of Hyde Park at the University of Chicago, he noticed that he made people nervous, and they'd avoid him on the street, look the other way. And he realized from that kind of behavior that he was being seen through the lens of a negative stereotype about his group, that he was being seen as a potentially menacing African-American young man. It was tension. And to diffuse that, he stumbled on the tactic of whistling Vivaldi, which instantly prevents people from seeing him stereotypically.
Well, actually, it just changes things from race to class, doesn't it?
It does, and it can do that. Since it doesn't change his race, it clearly changes the kind of he's now seen as a learned, sophisticated, worldly person.
Of course, the people who are listening to him whistle have to know what Vivaldi sounds like.
I think it's classical music. I don't think.
Are there certain times in our lives when stereotype threat has a bigger influence on us? When we're in school, or do we have to wait until we go to the workplace, when we're trying to prove our bona fides?
I think it has particularly poignant effects in school. Groups whose abilities our intellectual abilities are negatively stereotyped in society. Women in math, minorities, African-American, Latino students, pretty much across the academic board, when they're performing at the sort of frontier of their skills, trying to get better at academic work, this threat can be powerful enough and distracting enough to affect that performance.
And you say you can learn a lot from watching a high school lunchroom?
Yes. I mean, they're so organized by race. I think it reflects in some ways the kind of reciprocating stereotype threats that people have.
But it works in a number of different ways. I remember in college I was a member of the jazz club, and the black members of the jazz club didn't sit with the other white members when we had lunch. They sat with other black guys, and we asked them why, and they said, "Well, we don't have to talk about race. We can talk about girls and stuff."
Yeah.
But it was a kind of a self-imposed segregation.
I think there is a push and a pull there. You know, the integrated conversation in American life has a form of stereotype threat for both parties. Let's say we're talking blacks and whites. Blacks could worry that they'd be seen through negative stereotypes about blacks, intelligence and the like. Whites could worry just as much that they'd be seen through negative stereotypes about whites as perhaps racist or insensitive.
Well, sticking
puts
with
a tension in the conversation.
I remember black friends in college explaining why they all registered for their history courses with a white southern-born professor rather than the more famous black professor. They said the white southern-born professors defensively would mark them higher, and the black professor would demand more of them.
Hmm. This was white students?
These are black students.
These are black students who are saying that.
Yeah, I said, why are you all taking this white guy's course?
Yeah, that's
we had this very famous black history professor.
Uh-huh. That's interesting.
And that had to do
maybe
with,
they were right.
But that all had to do with stereotypes as well.
Yeah, yeah. You worry. I mean, I'm worried a little bit about the black professor in that story. Maybe he was seeing the students to protecting himself from being seen in terms of a stereotype and being extra mm-hmm. demanding and so on.
Well, tell us about some of the ways that educators and policymakers have tried to bridge the achievement gap between capable and motivated minorities and capable majorities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, it's a kind of preoccupation in America, this achievement gap, and I think it reflects a couple of things, the main thing being the fact that educational opportunity and resources are not really equally distributed in the society by race or by social class, and I think that's the biggest source of it, that the quality of schools you have access to, your family has access to, that's the biggest part of the story. Where we come in and where the process of stereotype threat and these identity threats come in are at the level of kids who've kind of gotten pretty identified with school and it's important to them. They care about succeeding. For example, a lot of our research has been done on Stanford University's campus, a very selective student body. That's where the stereotype threat pressures, I think, play a bigger role.
What is disidentification, and how is it connected to stereotype threat?
Well, I'll give you an example. Let's say I'm a woman, and I'm going along in math. I get to college. I've been pretty good. There have been a lot of women in my math classes all along, but now I'm starting to take more difficult, higher-level classes, fewer women, more men. I start to see that if I'm going to have a career in this area, I'm going to have to live in a world that's structured more this way and so on. I do feel the pressure of stereotype threat in that situation. One thing I can do to protect myself is to find another direction for my life to take, one that isn't as dependent on math. And I can disidentify, drop that as an identity. And then it isn't so important to me what happens in that domain. So that's kind of what the term disidentifying refers to, is a sort of protective dropping of identification with a domain so that I don't have to deal with the threat in it.
But many women and some other minorities don't fall through the gap. Some succeed.
They do. And we've done a fair amount of research as to what helps that happen. There are a lot of things that help that happen. For example, women who succeed in math, especially American women, women who come from societies where there is a much weaker gender stereotype about math ability tend to do well in our math classes in the United
Which
States.
Which groups would they be?
Often from Eastern Europe, some mm-hmm. Asian societies where they were reared in societies. Like in Poland, for example, we did research there early on. Half the mathematicians, half the engineers are women. So the stereotype isn't very strong there.
I found it interesting that in China, girls are not valued highly, and there's been a major gap in population as because of that mm-hmm. Over the last 15, 20 years. But in America, Chinese girls are encouraged to succeed. So did something happen when people came from China to the United States?
They're in a different
system. I'm talking about the children of immigrants.
Yeah. Yes. They're in a different society with a different set of feelings about them. So it's very difficult to succeed in a society that you perceive as not wanting you. But in a society where that's all gone, now you're open. And achievement is a real opportunity for you. And that's probably what's happening for them in the United States.
Sherman James talks about John Henryism in the African-American community. What's that?
John Henryism is trying very hard to disprove the stereotype, to succeed despite it. And when you're in a situation where that pressure is intense and constant, you're trying to do something your group hasn't done before. You're pioneering, in a sense. You can try hard enough that it begins to have a physical cost. And that's where what he looks at, hypertension as an outgrowth of this.
But actually, stereotype threat is baggage that people bring with them into any situation.
You know, I've tried to resist that interpretation of it because it's something that the very most successful people in a group can experience. You don't have to believe that stereotype is true. All you have to do is know that other people may see and judge you that way, and then all of a sudden you got a situation to contend with.
Well, what happens with African immigrants to the United States? As I understand it, first-generation African immigrants don't feel the stereotype threat as much as their children.
That's right. We did research comparing first- and second-generation black immigrants, and you don't find strong stereotype threat effects in the first generation, but you do in the second generation. Our explanation is that in the first generation, you have dialect differences and other characteristics that may allow you to understand that people are not going to see you as a part of that group that's so negatively stereotyped as an African American. They're going to see you as somehow different, and that gives you a little bit more space.
You say that the success of black students may depend less on expectations and motivation, things that are thought to drive academic performance, than on trust that stereotypes about their group will not have a limiting effect on their school world.
The interesting thing, I started out believing the first, mm-hmm. that expectations and motivations were the primary thing.
And
I think
that
they
parents
are
had to get their kids motivated, yeah. And that one of the big problems is that parents in some minority communities just do not push their kids as hard as they could.
Right. And whereas I think that does happen, there are big parts of the population where these kids are already very motivated, have high expectations, have high skills, have gone to great skill schools, but the underperformance is still there. And there's where I think this issue about being able to trust that in the academic environment you're not going to be seen and treated stereotypically, and that what's happening to you is not coming from these stereotypes. That's the issue for that sector of the population.
My guest is Claude M. Steele, currently the provost of Columbia University and the author of numerous published articles on psychology and related matters. His book, Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us, is published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in this hour, find out how viral infections from millions of years ago have affected how humans react to viruses today. Plus, we'll take a look in our second hour at the art of choosing and the impact excessive choices can have on our mental health. A reminder that this week, the Senate Judiciary Committee is holding hearings on Elena Kagan's nomination to the Supreme Court. You can see and hear gavel-to-gavel coverage streamed live at WNYC.org. And then tune in each night for NPR's wrap-up of the day's hearings. That's at 8 p.m. on AM 820 WNYC. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Claude M. Steele, his book Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us, published by Norton. How did you become interested in the social sciences and social psychology specifically?
It's an interesting question. I always enjoyed this level of analysis that I found when I was in college and took a social psychology course. It's the science that's about everyday life, the experiences of everybody in everyday life. And so you get to be very rigorous about that, and you sort of pull back the cover of what's on the surface of everyday life, and you get to look under it and kind of see and understand things. So that's the thrill of being a social psychologist.
It also gives you a chance to apply your own experiences to something academic.
Yes.
And I assume somebody like Kenneth Clark was an inspiration because that's what he did.
Exactly. He was a major existence proof for me that somebody like me could succeed in this business. So he's an important figure for me.
But the research is important to you. You say you didn't take an offer from Michigan because it would have taken you away from your research.
And but, at that time, indeed.
But now you're a provost at Columbia.
Provost, so I have to eat those words. there's a time in life for everything. That's how I think about things. And I enjoy the work of being a provost in my mid-60s. But at that time, that was some 20 years ago, I was all out about the research.
And where did you begin your research? Who did you study first?
I did my graduate work at Ohio State, and that's where I joined up in the science of social psychology.
How does this work? It can't just be observing. You've said a number of times during our conversation that you believe something and then it turned out to not be true.
Yes.
So do you start off with a hypothesis and then test it?
Yes. This is what I try to capture in this book. You start out with an interesting and important problem. Why are these kids at these great schools, these women, these minorities, why are they not doing what their prior grades and their test scores predict? And then you try a variety of hypotheses, and you have some hunches, and you listen to people. Everybody has hunches because that's the level at which social psychology functions, is at the level where everybody kind of has theories about that. And you test them rigorously, and this is the beauty of it, is that when you put things to empirical tests, your hunches are very often disconfirmed, and you find out something else that you never thought of before. And that's really how the phenomenon of stereotype threat came to light. We never had that idea before we started the research.
Well, it's my sense that some of the things we're talking about are all true to some degree. Motivation is true. Class is a factor. I know growing up white in poor neighborhoods, I never imagined that I'd go to a good school, so I didn't apply to any good schools. An upper middle class black kid would definitely want to go to Yale or Harvard or whatever. And if the kid didn't get in, maybe the argument would be that there were racial reasons. But still, that kid would have aspired for reasons that had nothing to do with race.
Yes, yes. I think that if you mean that class and race are different things,
they're all factors, and many people have complained that affirmative action doesn't really work the way it was intended to, because most of the affirmative action kids who get into schools are kids from more affluent families. They're more likely to actually be able to afford going to the school on their own, and it's the poor kids who don't have a chance who aren't even being considered.
This is a preoccupation in higher education. Over the last number of years, schools like Columbia have need-blind admissions, which is you apply and you're assessed for whether you're going to get in or not. And once you get in, we make it possible for everybody who gets in to come. That's an example of a policy which is designed to correct for some of the issues you're raising where to make quality higher education something that's an opportunity for a broader set of people.
You say that stereotype threat is not the same as self-fulfilling prophecy. But
right.
It looks like it, doesn't it?
People do look at it that way sometimes. But the thing that revealed itself to us, and that's always the way this, that's been the experience of doing this research, is having things be revealed. It's not so much that I believe something and then just fulfill it. It's much more that I know what you could be thinking, and I start to contend with it. And I have to contend with it because you're important to me, and I have to deal with that.
As you point out, a black man might wear a tie to the airport where somebody else might not,
right,
simply to help him get through certain things.
Yeah, I've had a very distinguished colleague tell me that. He said, I always wear a tie when I fly on airplanes. And I said, why? And he said, well, you know, it's not so much for the regular course of things, but if something goes wrong, then it's really great for a black person to have a tie on, and you're seen differently. So he's with that behavior, he's whistling Vivaldi. He's controlling what stereotypes are going to be used to judge him.
I want to get back to affirmative action because
I do this mainly with age these days. We say things and do things to not be seen, mm-hmm, in terms of the negative views of people who are in their advanced middle age.
You don't want to be judged as being old as you are.
Well, I mean, there are circumstances where there are negative views of people who are in their advanced middle age, and you don't want to be judged by those negative views.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real problem for a stereotype threat in some form or another is a problem for all of us.
Well, that's the point you're trying to make. The first thought here would be to talk about race or ethnicity.
That's right.
Or sex, but it can be anything.
And
that's why we have all those isms, ageism.
Yeah. Could be your political affiliation. Could be the region of the country you come from, the dialect you have.
So where do they all come from? I mean, there are reasons for those stereotypes developing, aren't there?
Well, that's a big question. That's almost like a how did the universe begin question. I think stereotypes arise from the way a society is organized in a basic way, and the way in which it's organized around certain identities. The reason race is so important and such a source of stereotypes in the United States is because we have a racial history of our society being organized that way. If you moved us to the show to Lagos, Nigeria, race would probably not be that important an identity, and there might not be that many stereotypes about it because everybody's of the same race. Maybe religion would be the identity that's more central to how that society is organized and has therefore more stereotypes about it. But in the United States, the stereotype structure reflects the history and the background of our society.
But we also buy into the stereotypes about our group, don't we?
Sometimes. I think we do that less than people think. And that comes to me, again, as from doing this research, that you find very few people who believe the negative things said about their groups. And so the whole idea, which was the central idea in psychology and sociology in the 20th century, was that groups believed the stigmas that were imposed on them and internalized them, and that became a source of their own self-fulfilling prophecies. But when you look more closely, we just don't find that much evidence of people deeply internalizing these things. It's more this kind of intersubjective thing. I know what you could think, and so in this particular situation that's important to me, I have to contend with it.
My guest is Claude M. Steele. His book, Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us, published by W.W. Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Tell us about some of the experiments in solutions to stereotype threat that you've conducted.
That's a good question. There is an overall strategy, which let's say you think of a workplace or a classroom as a good place to think about. What has to be done to minimize stereotype threat there? It's an integrated classroom. You have to, in principle, establish a sense of safety among the students, a sense of trust that even though their group's abilities are negatively stereotyped in a larger society, they won't be negatively stereotyped in this situation. That's the goal. Then there are a lot of tactics, a variety of tactics that we've explored in our research to show how to do that. One way to do that is, surprisingly, to be very demanding, but to be affirming of a student's ability to meet those demands. That immediately signals to the student in a very profound, impactful way that they're not being seen through the lens of a stereotype.
Well, those are when we the stereotype is underachieving. What happens with Asians who are often seen as overachievers? The kid comes in and feels that the expectations are a lot higher than he or she can live up to.
Yes, I had a student, a graduate student once, who went on the job market and was seen as somebody that could automatically teach statistics and wasn't very good at it. Again, it's the principle is clear. There has to be a sense that people see the person beneath the group identity, that they see a real individual there, that they can get past that and not and are not using stereotypes about the group to interpret the person.
This is easier said than done.
Easier said than done. That's why the tactics are more important than the principle.
And what about this tendency more and more to test these days? We have No Child Left Behind, and we have all sorts of other standardized tests. Is that affected by what we've been discussing?
Yes, I'm worried about it. I think there are ways of giving tests which can minimize these effects. But as you know, most of the research in the book is on test performance, the effects of stereotype threat on test performance. And stereotype threat gets very intense when the stakes around the test get high. So when you sort of have these big summary tests, the SAT, end-of-the-year standardized tests, I think the minority students whose abilities are negatively stereotyped, you're going to see stereotype threat depressing their performance in those situations. There's evidence from California statewide that that's what happens. So we're using tests at one level for what we think of as a good reason, but an unintended consequence is that we may actually increase the minority achievement gap that we're so worried about as an artifact of that.
There have been all sorts of suggestions for returning to some form of segregation or another, same-sex schools, for example, because then you don't have that sense of somebody being treated as superior to the other. Would segregation, a reinstatement of racial segregation, have a positive effect in some ways?
I'm an integrationist.
This is a loaded question. I understand.
I know, but it's something I've been thinking a lot about recently. That because it is the case that these effects that we're talking about are less in segregated situations, both for women, for example, at African American colleges, historically black colleges and universities, educate about 17% of the African American population of college students, but they educate about 60% of those that go on in quantitatively based fields like being physicians, dentists, engineers, and the like. The same pattern would hold for women's colleges if you look at which schools produce women, lead women into quantitatively based fields. Those are the facts on the ground. I think our research is aimed at how do you make the integrated situation work for all students, and that's the thrust of our research.
Well, you said there are certain tactics. You have any examples?
The first one I got to there was demanding work and affirmation of ability. The book, I should point out, has a long list of these. But another one is our existence-proof role models and critical mass. That is, as you mentioned earlier, Kenneth Clark was really important to me because he was, and especially in those days, proof that someone like me could succeed in the field. Well, that tends to reduce my subjective sense that the pressures I'm under aren't solvable. So that's how role models can be very effective. Critical mass, that is, having a number of people of my identity in the situation. That tells me that, well, you can succeed here, and these pressures, even if they're bad, they're not so bad that I can't succeed here.
I suspect that you have followed all of the coverage in the press and the internet and everywhere else of President Obama, and I suspect that you've seen certain things that confirm much of what you've written about here.
I think that the principle, the tactic I just mentioned, he's sort of a national implementation of that tactic to have an African American president. I'd be the first to say this is not a cure-all, but you have to really accept the fact that this is a major piece of progress.
But hasn't he also been a victim of stereotype threat?
Certainly. I'm sure I'd love to talk to him. I'm certain throughout his life he's been very adept at handling that pressure.
I want to thank you so much for coming by and being very adept at being a guest on this show. Claude M. Steele, who is the provost at Columbia University, writing about the research that he and others in his field have done in a book called Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us. It's published by W.W. Norton. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Up next, geneticist Hermit Malek explains his work in paleovirology and how viral infections from earlier stages of evolution, some from over millions of years ago, have affected how humans react to viruses today. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.